remember what we saw on our television screens during the whole course of the last summer. It was people fleeing the conflict in Syria and other people fleeing difficulties in their part of the world to come to Europe. And what that reminds us of is my definition of, what is it? What does humankind mean at the beginning of the 21st century? It is a story of interdependence. We're 7 billion, we're just over 7 billion people on the planet. By the end of this century, we're told, we will be 11 billion people on this planet. And we'll be sharing the world. And that fact alone should bring home to us a fundamental truth that we have to work with other countries to deal with the problems and the opportunities that are facing our world. Now, what are they? We know about the extraordinary pace at which technology is transforming our lives. We know and can see the rise of new global powers, and Andrew Small in his chapter on China, Stevens on how we should relate to Russia, address those very directly. The crisis in Syria, the rise of Daesh and its terrorist franchise, the extent to which economic and social advance comes with trade as it opens people's minds around the world. Very, very old problems, poverty, and very new challenges like climate change. And I think all of those things call on us to look outwards to the world. And that is why the decision that the British people are going to make this summer, as they vote in the European referendum, we think it's going to be this summer, will be the most important choice we have made as a nation, well, certainly for 40 years, about our place in the world. Because I think it will be a decision that will determine whether, in the eyes of others, Britain remains an outward-facing country, or whether we demonstrate that we have decided to turn in on ourselves. And look, I think the arguments for remaining in the European Union are overwhelmingly strong. It has been highly successful in bringing peace to a continent which had been scarred by conflict for century after century. It has brought us jobs, investment, growth, and security. It has strengthened our voice in the world. This is a really important argument in this debate that we're going to have. This is not, our membership of the European Union hasn't weakened Britain's voice in the world. It has amplified Britain's voice in the world. And whereas we know what in is like, with all its imperfections, because to argue for Britain to remain in the European Union does not mean that the European Union is a perfect institution that cannot be improved upon. It isn't, and it can. But it is to recognise we know what it is, whereas we're being asked by those who are campaigning for out to take a giant leap into the unknown and the uncertain at the beginning of the 21st century with all of the things that are going on in the world. And I would just say from my own experience in the field of foreign policy, Europe's ability to come together as a group of nations and to speak with one voice. I saw it with my own eyes when I led the British delegation to the climate change talks in Bali in 2007, which each of those conferences has been a small step, and in Paris we saw a big step. But believe you me, it was incredibly powerful that the nations of Europe came together and said, right, that's what we're prepared to put on the table by way of a commitment to tackle climate change. All of the member states as one. Now that is a strength, not a weakness. The fact that Europe was of one voice in the fight for debt relief for the developing world in the run-up to the 2005 Gleneagles Summit. The way in which countries have come together to work with the problems that we've seen recently in relation to Russia and Iran, and the Iran nuclear deal has been a very significant and important development. It was the right thing to do, and it's helping to bring about profound change. And I think what that reminds us, in the European context, is just how important strong international institutions are. But they need to be institutions that will reflect the world as it is now, and not the world as it was. And on that subject, can I say this about the United Nations, which is the instrument that we created out of the ashes of the Second World War to deal with problems of international peace and security, addressed by Jo in her essay and also in what Jo has been doing in Parliament so ably on the conflict in Syria. Now, the UN has a unique responsibility because of its authority and its unique legitimacy, representing the nations of the world. But I would say that the membership of the Security Council reflects the world as it was and not the world as it is. And we should be saying, you know what, the membership of the Security Council, the permanent members, needs to expand to reflect the world of today, to bring in Brazil and Germany, India, Japan, and a country from Africa. I think we have to accept that the veto exists amongst the permanent members because it binds those countries into the UN as a system, but with it comes a great responsibility. And that is why the French government has proposed that in the case of mass atrocities, the Security Council would reach an agreement that voluntarily it would agree not to use its veto in those cases. And there's a mechanism that is proposed as to how you decide whether that threshold had been met. Now, I think this is a really important proposal, and I think it's one that should be strongly supported by all of us, because there are two issues in relation to the UN. One is to get agreement to do something about threats to international peace and security, and we saw the resolution passed on Syria in the run-up to the decision that was taken in Parliament just before Christmas. The second issue is, if you agree that something should be done, it's a practical one, on behalf of the world community, who's going to do the work? Who's prepared to act? And that is why, where there are people to protect or peace to keep, we need more peacekeepers. Now, at the moment, there are around 125,000 military and civilian UN peacekeepers, compared with only 11,000 a quarter of a century ago. So that tells you a story about the demand there is out there in the world to try and secure peace, to ensure that peace is maintained, and to protect people facing difficulty. But despite that big increase, there are still not enough peacekeepers for all the missions that the United Nations would wish to run to the high standard that I think all of us would expect of them. And I think this is an area in which Britain as a country should and could play a much, much bigger role, given the skill we have, the experience and the expertise of our armed forces. And the third thing I wanted to say in opening this evening's discussion is this. Whether it is about how we're going to deal with conflict, or global poverty, or climate change, there is a truth that we have to face, and it is this. Take the example of climate change. Now, what we understand why it matters, but to think of the practicalities. Having in my job as the International Development Secretary met people who had decamped from where they were born and brought up to come and live somewhere else, bent the twigs into the sand, been to the town rubbish tip of the town they'd moved into to get scraps of cardboard and plastic to frame them over their temporary shelters. Why had they done that? Because it stopped raining where they were living. Now, if it stops raining where you're living, well, you can't grow any crops. And if you can't grow any crops, you can't eat. And if you can't eat, you're going to die. And what will human beings do faced with those circumstances? They'll do what human beings have done throughout the whole course of human history. They'll move. And they'll move somewhere where they can live. And the same will be true if instead of a future for some people of not enough water, there is the alternative of too much water, rising sea level. Look at the map of the world. Look at the places that will be affected if we don't tackle dangerous climate change by rising sea levels, if the scientists are right about the predictions that they are making. And if you look at a country like Bangladesh, where many, many people live less than the height of the ceiling of this room above sea level, and a number of them, those who live on the chorelands every year, have to move when the floodwaters come. If sea levels rise, Bangladesh is moving house, and it's probably going to move next door. So it's another reminder that events, circumstances, a changing climate that affects people in one country is going to affect those of us who live somewhere else. And the same is true of young people who've gone to school. One of the great successes of the world is more and more children are now in primary school. The number who aren't where they should be on a Tuesday morning in a desk, sitting at a desk in a classroom with a teacher, because the right to an education is fundamental to the chance we're going to have in life, allied with the love and care and encouragement of those who bring us into this world. But as they grow up, go into secondary education and then discover there isn't opportunity in their country, they too, in a world in which they're much more aware of what's happening elsewhere, think about the chance to move. Now, that is the argument, that is the reproach to those who say, well, why are we as a country spending so much on development? Why are we so concerned about dealing with conflict? Why are we talking about better financial systems in countries? Why are we talking about reforming border control so that goods can move freely? Why are we talking about security on the land so farmers can invest and improve the land to grow more crops? Now, some people might think, what's that got to do with development? It's got everything to do with development, because it is in our own interest, in the best sense of the world, that there should be prosperity and development in all the parts of the world, so people have the opportunity to establish a life, to have a family, to raise their children, to live in safety in the land in which they were born, if that's what they want. And that is why I said in my introduction that, you know, the argument, well, there are no votes in foreign policy and people aren't really interested in that, I believe fundamentally to be a mistaken view. And I think all of us here tonight should want to say a big thank you to all of the contributors to this pamphlet, because this is about the future of our small and fragile planet, the part that we're going to play in it, and ultimately it's about the future of our children and our grandchildren, and we need to get it right to pass on a better world to them. Thank you very much.
Hilary, thank you very much indeed for picking up the title of this, Outward to the World, and running with it. Thanks. We're going to move straight on to Joe Cox. In a second, would a couple of people like to sit down, as we don't have Daniel Levy and Phoebe on the condition that they get up if these people appear and also don't take their speaking slot. But please do. And also the gentleman, are you, just if you're standing in front of other people. And if anyone wants to pull this seat to the side and grab that, please do. Joe, absolutely. As you've written a fantastic piece on globalisation here, and as Hilary is saying, we've also been talking a lot about Syria. How would you like to respond to this?
Brilliant. Well, it's always a joy, thank you, Bronwyn, to join two committed internationalists as Hilary and Stephen. And I think this is a really timely debate in terms of the conversations that we as the Labour Party need to have. So I'm going to focus specifically on humanitarian intervention, which I think is an issue that we as a party are grappling with, and I think that we as a country need to grapple with. I was an aid worker for 10 years, so I've seen firsthand the benefits and challenges of an active international approach. You know, I've sat down with Sudanese women who've been gang raped repeatedly because the world wasn't there to save them. Child soldiers who the world abandoned, you know, survivors from the genocide in Rwanda. So I have seen how an active international approach, with the UK leading some of those debates, both at the UN Security Council and at the EU, can make a transformative, life-saving difference to people's lives. And I feel, perhaps now more than in a long time actually, that we've forgotten that an active UK foreign policy is not a given. You know, that consensus and action we built to save lives in Kosovo or Sierra Leone doesn't happen automatically. You have to fight for it. You have to take that space. And we as a government did that, and I think we as a party now need to think again about where we sit on some of these big choices. And that space is, and always has been, highly contested. Across the political spectrum, actually, by an increasingly nationalist and isolationist right, but also by those on the left who I feel sometimes are willing to show huge amounts of personal solidarity with international causes, but don't see all the time a role for the state. And I fundamentally disagree with that theory. I think the state can have a transformative role to play internationally, and we as a party should always advance that argument loudly and strongly. And, you know, if anyone wants a reminder about what non-intervention, what non-action grounded in human rights and the protection of civilians look like, you know, I don't think we need to look much further than Syria for an incredibly stark illustration of what can happen when the world ignores a crisis, a political and humanitarian crisis on that magnitude. I think the government's incoherent, short-sighted approach to Syria let that crisis escalate. And it wasn't just the UK government, it was the international community. And I think, to our shame, we looked away when we should have acted, grounded in the protection of civilians. And we need to reclaim that space, I think, as a party. And, you know, this isn't for me about being pro or anti-military intervention. That's far too simplistic an option. It's much more about the principles that we as a party, that we as a party in government will one day have to set out that guide those decisions about when it is appropriate to intervene to protect civilians. And for me, this is about moving on from the shadow of the Iraq war, which I felt as a new MP in this place for 9 months haunts many colleagues still. And I think it's time to learn the right lessons from Iraq, which for me means not throwing the baby out with the bathwater and not rejecting what Robin Cook started to set out back in 94, 95, which was some pretty groundbreaking principles that meant the UK would be an active player to protect lives. And obviously that then led to the UN adopting the Responsibility to Protect Doctrine, which I worked for a decade on making sure the world acted on. And I don't want to see us as a party forget that lesson, as well as the other valuable lessons we need to learn from the Chilcot Inquiry and Iraq. So I'll finish so that Stephen can say a few comments before we have to go to vote. But for me, it's shocking that we actually don't have explicit UK policy right now on the prevention of mass atrocities and genocide. And there's no sort of explicit UK mechanism on the prevention of genocide and an ability to act to prevent mass atrocities. I think that's a gap at the heart of our foreign policy thinking. And I think the big critique that I would make of this government in the coalition and now is their lack of principles, their lack of grand strategy, their lack of a long-term approach means that some of the decisions we have taken are not grounded in the kind of principles that I would want to see those decisions taken in. But I think we as a party need to reclaim the space on humanitarian intervention. I think we need to challenge this government to be much more creative about what it does to protect civilians right now in Burundi, in the CAR, and in Syria. And in doing so, I think we can reclaim some of that language and narrative and passion and commitment that Robin Cook set out so passionately in 95. Thanks, Bronwyn.
Joe, thank you very much indeed. Let's go straight on to Stephen because of the 7 o'clock hanging over us.
Thanks, yeah, very much. It's like Saved by the Bell. Yeah. Wait for that bell to ring. Many, many thanks, and thanks to Hilary and Joe for kicking us off in such an inspiring way. I mean, I certainly would kick off by agreeing absolutely that foreign policy is playing an absolutely critical role in the way that people think, and indeed the way that the British electorate behaves and thinks, often without even knowing that it is playing that role. If you think about the refugee crisis, about the EU referendum, and indeed an issue that's very close to my heart, given the announcements yesterday of huge job losses in the steelworks in my constituency of Port Talbot, what a huge amount of that is about is the dumping of Chinese steel on the global markets. And a big debate that we need to have with this government is it right for them to say, on the one hand, that they're trying to tighten up on dumping, and on the other, supporting market economy status for China? I think this is the big political issue coming down the line in terms of our relationship with China, and it's clearly incompatible, on the one hand, to say that you're standing up for British steel, and on the other hand, supporting market economy status for China. So this is just one of the issues which you just see the direct connection between the real lives of ordinary working people in my constituency and what is happening in Beijing. And there is, you know, those decisions are made and within a split second, people in my constituency are directly impacted. So the idea that foreign policy and international relations doesn't play a role in terms of our domestic policy politics is a complete and utter myth. Turning briefly to Russia, which was the focus of my chapter in the book, what I try to set out in my contribution is the desperate need to have a richer and deeper understanding of Russia's history, culture, and political psyche, without which we'll never get away from the atmosphere of saber-rattling and mutual suspicion which really characterises the current relationship. My experience there, having worked for the British Council, I was director of the British Council in St. Petersburg for 3 years. My observation is that Russia is driven by a sense of encirclement anxiety. This is a country with vast external borders which are impossible to defend, and that shapes the entire way in which Russia thinks about the rest of the world, the way it engages with both its neighbours and the rest of the world. The basis is these are people that should be there should be grounds for suspicion, because we can't defend ourselves. We must strike out first. We must subjugate our potential enemies and dominate them. And in that sense, it is an imperial mindset, but it's one which is based on entirely understandable geopolitical reasons. And until we understand that in the UK, we'll never really understand where the Russians are coming from. What I argue in the chapter is that we therefore need a new doctrine for the way in which we engage with Russia that I call respect-based realism. And on that basis, you can actually start to have a genuine reset with Russia. And that respect-based realism is about saying we understand the narrative of Russian history. We can't accept everything that you want to do as a result of that narrative, but we at least want to have a dialogue with you. And on that basis, start to look at some of the specific issues. Now, clearly, Ukraine is a huge issue. And what I argue there is we must, of course, continue to support sanctions on Ukraine and further sanctions if the Russians continue to show aggression. But at the same time, I think we should also make it crystal clear that we do not believe that the extension of NATO to Ukraine is a good idea. It doesn't make sense from a military point of view. A dilapidated military capability of the Ukrainian army won't add anything to NATO, and it doesn't make sense from a strategic point of view either. Should we push on, or should we go and vote?
I think you should go and vote. And I tell you, let me just say two words. You've all talked about engagement, and then we've had, from Hillary, particularly a bit about, many-sided, but also about aid within that, Syria, Russia. What I suggest we do for the next 5-10 minutes until they come back is have a discussion here. So I pull together some of these things, and then have an even livelier one when you come back.
Great. Okay?
Thank you. Great. Do we have, I'm looking around the room, by any chance, Daniel Levy or Phoebe Griffiths? I don't think so. They are all, sort of compatriots in the foreign affairs tribe of mine. I don't think we do. Well, can I commend to you what they've written in here, Phoebe on migration, and Daniel, who's one of the most thoughtful writers on the Middle East and North Africa, has written in this as well. What I'd like to do now, as I said, is have a discussion with people. When you say what you feel about these things, Hillary's made this pitch for engagement, many-sided engagement, EU, all kinds of institutions, and obviously with his background as the former international development secretary, with this pitch for aid and aid working. On the other hand, there is an awful lot of reporting at the moment about how Britain gives some of its aid budget through other institutions like the EU and the World Bank, and whether that is a good use of our money or not. We've had from Joe comments about Syria, how we should have got engaged. I would like to hear when she comes back, what the three of them think we should now do. And Russia, we've had a subtle, passionate pitch from Stephen about how we should approach that complicated country. I'd love to hear what you think now. And let's pull these things together. Speaking now does not mean you won't get a chance to put your points to them later. But just on this cluster of things we've heard, anyone like to stand up and say what you think? Please.
Thank you. Inspired by Jo Cox, and she's obviously an idealist who's actually gone out there and done the hard yards herself, and that's thoroughly admirable. I have to say I've got major problems about the efficacy of military intervention. If you look at it, I think you've got to choose your quarrel, if you like. Funnily enough, things like the Falklands, Grenada, Sierra Leone, arguably Kosovo, it sort of works. And it sort of works because you hand over to somebody else who then runs the place afterwards. I think where it's failing is Iraq Syria and Libya. And although in those cases, or well, certainly in the case of Iraq and Libya, military victory came very easily, and all the problems have come about basically the failure of the army as a state builder, despite pouring billions of dollars in. And I would support Joe, for instance, if we were looking at non-military means of intervening and influencing things, and looking closely at the background of these countries, how they work, who's going to take over, how it's going to play out afterwards. But I'm very uncomfortable with the military side. And I think it also generates a lot of antibodies out there against the West as well. Thank you very much.
No, thank you. No, thanks. That's very good. I didn't catch your name, I'm sorry.
It's Bill Doherty.
Bill Doherty. No, you put it very well, and I must say, just listening to you, I think the common theme in what doesn't work is when there isn't a government there and we're trying to create it, and I think the same is true of development or aid. If there isn't a government there, it is extraordinarily hard to get anything working, or as you point out, in places like Sierra Leone or Kosovo, it is much easier. Who else would like to make a point? There were quite a few hands up a minute ago, please.
Thank you. John, I'd like to return to the issue of development.
Yes.
Because there are currently proposals for the TTIP and also on the other side of the world, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And I have to be honest, I'm not sure whether I know as much as I should do about those. But the crucial point I think we need to ask ourselves is, are these proposals advantageous for the development of the issue that we want? Because there are quite a number of people who, just put it mildly, are very apprehensive about it. But the simple point is, I don't think we know enough about it, and I would include myself in that.
Interesting. Thank you very much indeed. Who else would like to say something? As I said, there's no bar to speaking now and speaking later. It probably increases.
Is there a
chapter
there?
Oh, there is. I beg your pardon. I do beg your pardon.
I agree a bit with what Hilary Benn was saying about the need to be open and intervene within the world for big issues like climate change. But I don't think he explained very well how we're going to deal with some people who may be our enemies. So he didn't really go into how we might have to deal with Russia when we're dealing with Syria. We're going to have to talk to Russia, and also different sorts of things with Saudi Arabia at the moment. They have a very bad human rights record, and there's a big thing about when they executed that guy from Iran a few weeks ago, and he didn't really explain how we're going to deal with these sorts of people if we're going to get a more peaceful world. And I think we're going to have to deal with these people whether we like it or not. So I don't think he went through that very well. And also how that affects, dealing with these people, how it affects the smaller state people, with ISIS, with their taxes.
Great point. You put it very well. Again, I didn't catch your name.
Yusuf.
Yusuf, fantastic. No, very, very good. And who else we got? The woman right at the back.
I think Joe's point about lack of imagination principle and the way that this current government is dealing with Syria, I think there are a huge comparisons between the way that Major's government dealt with Eastern Europe and the conflicts there. And I think that the Labour Party should be more willing to challenge. And I think if we are concerned about having, or the Labour Party concerned about having principles and deciding what the Labour Party stand for around humanitarian intervention, now is the time to do this, because it was the Labour Party that had to challenge around Eastern Europe in the 90s, and the world is reliant on somebody to step around now and create some principles. And the other thing I'll say is I'm so pleased to hear that somebody is willing to talk about responsibility to protect, even if just in principle for now, to return to that after Iraq, because to do that,
great point, Rachel. And where do you think? Are you thinking of particular parts of the world when you're talking about where Labour should challenge?
Well, I think it's around the principle of intervention in Syria. I think it's obviously the clear important
thing. Yeah, fantastic. Thank you very much. And let's have one here while we're waiting for Joe.
Good evening. I started reading a book, I have not finished it yet, it's written by Andy Kissinger, which is called the book of New World Order. He more or less discusses the same issues as written in this book, although a completely different political field, of course. And he says it's quite remarkable that the world has globalized very quickly and intensively over the last few decades, but from an economical perspective only, not from political, or not that quick. And he says if you want to solve or tackle the problems, you should create a new world order, so a new way of governing the world. And he's thinking about more regional governments, otherwise we will get stuck for the next few years. Curious about your opinion, Harriet.
Interesting. They're very, very good. And you're talking about his book, World Order. You're talking about his book, World Order.
Can you read out two key issues? It's the Bilderberg Group, which was established in the 1950s, 60s.
Yes.
And I know that Henry Kissinger and also Rockefeller from the past adapted this idea of a new world order as such, because economically things have developed, but no borders anymore. Politically, everyone sticks to his own system, his own religion, his own laws, and that should act like a tectonic plate in a world that it crashes. That's how he describes it.
And he sees, surprisingly, perhaps, a great role for elder statesmen in producing world order. I interviewed him about it. Great. And Joe sadly can't come back. But Stephen and Hillary, thank you. We had some very interesting points while you were out of the room. We had from Bill worries about military intervention and how do we get and worries about where if you I'm paraphrasing a bit, you'll forgive me, if you don't have a good government, whether either military intervention or state building or aid, you know, it has anything to get going with. So the sort of distinction between what works and what doesn't work. We had from John a question about TTIP and is it good or not, and how that fits in with the development. We had from Yusuf. You put very well, how do we deal with our enemies? Challenging you both, in a sense, on your vision of engagement. How do we deal with, you know, Russia, and you weren't labelling Russia as an enemy, you were following Stephen's point on this, but still, how do you deal with those who don't want to be brought into, in fact, a kind of Kissinger-like world order? And then we had from Rachel, should we be more willing to challenge and a vote for the RTP, for Responsibility to Protect. Hilary, do you want to come back on some of that?
Yes, if I may. Look, on just John on TTIP.
Where's John? John's
yeah. Opening up trade is generally a good thing. There is concerns about our public services and the health service. There are concerns about the investor-state dispute resolution mechanism. You can't have governments being undermined by that, but in any trade deal I've ever come across, you have to have some means of ensuring that people stick by the rules. It remains to be seen what will happen, but the European Parliament is definitely on the case, and as you know, has passed a number of motions, and we need to get it right, I would say. I want to just respond to your summary, Bronwyn, of what Bill Youssef, I caught the end of it, and what Rachel just had to say about how we deal with these most tricky questions. I too am a strong supporter of Responsibility to Protect, and I made a speech in Coventry about it in November. Why? Because if you accept the principle on which the UN was formed, if you look at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, now, it says quite, you know, a lot of very, very important things. And I think the question that we have to face the world is, if someone is on the receiving end of conflict or aggression or genocide, says, well, I've got hold of a copy of your document. These are fine principles. When are they going to be applied to me? And are any of you up for giving me a hand? So that's the first question that we have to confront. And it is immensely complex and difficult. I'm not simplifying it, but I'm making the point about why it should matter and why it should be our responsibility. The second is, in the past, there was a view that what happened within the sovereign nation state was the business of the sovereign nation state. And people would say, I'm really sorry, civil war can't intervene. And the parallel has been drawn, and for me it's a very powerful one to make the point. 40, 50 years ago, police got called to a man beating up his wife or his girlfriend and would say, sorry, that's inside the front door, it's in the kitchen. That is that's a domestic dispute. It's not really for us to intervene in this dispute between a man and his wife. Now, we don't accept that anymore. We say that the law, the rights that should apply to people, apply everywhere, whether it's inside the sovereign space of the domestic home or whether out in the street. And I suppose the principle is, should that apply also to our interdependent world and nation states? And I think it's a very, I think it's impossible to argue with that proposition, because would we accept in our nation peace and security in London, a civil war in Manchester, and genocide going on in Glasgow? The answer is no, we wouldn't. Now, why do we not have that? Because we have the rule of law, we have established an order, people generally stick by the rules. And this, all of these examples, and Jo touched on some when she spoke, are illustrations of how difficult it is to apply this in practice. Because one, can you get the United Nations to agree that something should be done? And the veto sometimes prevents that. Secondly, the question of who's going to do the work if it agrees to do something. And sometimes a fear that people will be asked to do the work leads to a lack of agreement about doing anything in the first place in the Security Council. And I'm a very strong supporter of building up regional capacity to undertake it. Why? Because of my experience as Development Secretary. Take the conflict in Darfur. The fact is, it was the second operation that the African Union had undertaken. It was the first major one. The previous one had been in Burundi, which was a much smaller scale. And great credit to Paul Nielsen, who was the EU Development Commissioner at the time. He was the first person to propose that some EU development money should be used to help support the African Union peacekeeping force in Darfur. I used development money to buy fuel for their vehicles. I used development money to buy vehicles, because Joe was talking about women who, when they went outside of the camps, got raped and attacked. Now, what is the purpose of having an AU force? To try and protect people while you hope that politics is going to solve the cause of the conflict in the first place. And building that regional capacity, I think, would help, would make it more likely that the world would reach agreement on the need to do something. Now, we are inconsistent, we are at times hypocritical, if you're taking the world as a whole, in deciding what we're going to do and where. But that does not mean, from my point of view, that the question should not be asked. And there are times, of course, where negotiation is the best way out, if it will work. And that's the only thing that will bring the Syrian civil war to an end, the Vienna process. And I support that very strongly. Jeremy and I have argued for that to move on, because if you're going to end the barrel bombing, you need a ceasefire. The only thing that's going to bring a ceasefire is the start of the talks between Assad and the group of people who he's now going to have to sit down with. But if you look at Daesh, well, I don't think there's much to negotiate with Daesh about, unless someone's going to take a different view. And there are times when groups like that have to be defeated. That was the argument I made in the House of Commons on the 2nd of December. And I know that divides opinion too.
And our President Assad, you live with him staying there or not?
I think that is for the Syrian people in the end to decide. Quite sensibly, I think the world community has said, look, if we can get the talks going, that is the most important thing. Certainly the Syrian refugees that I met in Jordan at the back end of last year had very strong views.
Yes, they've left.
Bromwyn on the subject. No, indeed, yeah. They have. No, they have left. Of course they have. Yeah. And it is for the Syrian people to decide what the future of their country is going to be. To return, they're going to have to be confident that the place is secure. They will need homes to return to. They want to know the politics is working. But it's their choice to make. And I think we should do all that we can to ensure that those diplomatic negotiations succeed to bring that civil war to an end.
I'm going to come back on some of those points. And Yusuf, I'm going to come back on your point about Saudi Arabia, which I've not forgotten. Stephen, do you want to say something on this?
I think Hilary covered a lot of it. I just wanted to come back on this idea of the new world order and thinking strategically about that. I actually agree entirely with the view that there's a huge disconnect between the globalization of our economy and the Westphalian order that we still see that defines our governing structures. We have a UN which is almost entirely dysfunctional, in my view. We have an IMF which doesn't reflect the realities of the globalized world without the right voice for the emerging economies at all. And so we have I think we are seeing, and it's been developing for a long time, a crisis of global governance. And my view is that the right way to address that crisis is through regional integration. That's why the European Union is the model that I think the rest of the world should follow. The reason that the European Union is having so much trouble is because it's ahead of its time. It's an idea which is pulling nation states into the future, and they're coming kicking and screaming because, of course, politicians don't like to surrender power or sovereignty. But the fact is, I think there will be a growing realization that that regional integration model is the only way that you can deal with globalization, particularly when you have such dysfunctional global organizations. So if we accept that premise of greater regional integration, then you might look at the continent of Asia, and you might say, how does Asia deal with the China problem? Because clearly that's the dominant, you know, China is the Germany of Asia. And what I think has been a huge success story is that the way in which the member states of the European Union have found a modus operandi and have found a way of cooperating and integrating, that's delivered peace and economic prosperity. It's a huge challenge so the theory is great, but when you actually look at the regional bloc, you know, the same with Africa. What do you do with the Nigeria and the South Africa, the two big players in that region, and how that would all fit together? So it's, in my view, it's a theory that holds a lot of water, but putting it into practice is very challenging when you look at the geopolitics of it.
I'm storing up more questions I want to ask, but let's have some from you. Some more. Gentleman here.
Hi, my name's Gurinder. I've recently graduated for the Masters in International Peace and Security. I work for the All Parties Group for Freedom, Religion and Belief in Parliament at the moment. We often hear talk about human rights being at the heart of our foreign policy. And Joe mentioned Robin Cook, who also talked about an ethical foreign policy. my question is about how do we balance promoting human rights while holding to account those regimes who violate human rights while maintaining our strategic interest with them? And should we be doing that? And of course, linking to Youssef's point earlier, I had Saudi Arabia in mind when asking this question.
Govinda, thanks very much indeed. And I want to stay on this point for a second. Yusuf did, as I was saying earlier, raise the question, how do we deal with Saudi Arabia? And so I'd like to ask you both explicitly, you know, should we sell arms to Saudi Arabia? And if we do, should we attach more conditions to them than we now do?
Well, shall I?
Yes,
yeah, if I respond to that. Look, on arms sales, matter of principle, I believe that all states have the right to acquire the means to defend themselves. And that's a principle. After all, if we hadn't had the means to defend ourselves in 1940, we wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation today. So that's the first point. The second point is you need a framework to decide when it is appropriate to make those sales, mm-hmm. Bronwyn or not. We have the consolidated criteria. We have the regime in Britain. The issue is how you apply it to particular circumstances, because it's all there. It talks about taking action when there's a risk that those arms might be used. And as it so happens, this morning I have written to the chairs of the Defence International Development Business and Foreign Affairs Select Committees to draw their attention to the reports of potential breaches of international humanitarian law in Yemen, where there is, of course, a conflict taking place between the Saudi-led coalition and the Houthi rebels. Médecins Sans Frontières, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and others have reported what they regard as breaches of international humanitarian law, and I've asked the government to undertake a review, and they have not done so. So I've now asked the chairs of the four select committees, because they are reportedly in the process of setting up the Committee on Arms Exports, which existed in the previous parliament, is not actually a statutory requirement. It's not even a requirement of Parliament. It is a voluntary arrangement put together by the chairs of the four select committees. And I've drawn their attention to this question because I think if the government isn't going to do its job of scrutinising how those arms are being used and whether, in fact, there are breaches of international humanitarian law taking place with the use of British arms, and that's why you need an investigation, then the next best is that the four select committees in setting up the Committee on Arms Exports should do so. The second point I would make is that when it comes, for example, to Saudi Arabia's use of the death penalty, which they make extensive use of, as a matter of principle, as a Labour Party, it is the view of the British government, we are opposed to the use of the death penalty in all circumstances. And I'm as critical of Saudi Arabia as I am of the land of my mother's birth, the United States of America, where the death penalty continues to operate in a number of states. It's a state jurisdiction, although it still exists at the federal level for certain crimes. And that is why when Sheikh Al-Nimr and three others as part of the 47 were executed at the beginning of this month, I said that the Saudis were profoundly wrong to have done that. I'm afraid that was not something the British government could quite bring themselves to say. So I think you have to be straight and honest. At the same time, recognise, and your question implied it, security cooperation between Britain and Saudi Arabia is really quite important, including in defending ourselves and them and other countries against groups that I referred to earlier, who would definitely like to come and do us harm, which is why the threat level in the United Kingdom is severe and why we are told that an attack is highly likely. And that tells us about the threat that we face.
Yeah, well, thank you both for that question. Stephen, do you want to say something on this general question of how do we respond to human rights abuses in other countries? How do we deal with both our enemies who we may not want to characterise as enemies, like Russia, and how do we deal with friends who do things we don't like?
I think that it is very difficult to put down a recipe which you can apply in a very sort of logical way in each case. It's not a cookie cutter because there are so many variations in terms of the relative weight of a particular argument in favour or against trading with a particular nation in relation to their own cultural context and what they do within their own penal system. So I think, for me, it's more a question of the mood music and the kind of language that we use in responding to, for example, the just almost industrial scale of the death penalty in Saudi Arabia. That there must surely be stronger language that we can use to condemn that. And also, as Hillary rightly pointed out, the fact that the committee has not been constituted for so long really does smack of something fishy going on there. So I think we've got to have a general sense of what we think is acceptable. We've got to use the strongest possible language to condemn, and we've got to make sure that we have a framework to ensure that the rules and regulations that we have on when you can trade, when you can sell arms to a particular country, are correctly applied. It's then our job, as the opposition, to hold this government to account and to be absolutely tough and uncompromising on them whenever we feel the need to be so.
And on aid, both of you, would you attach strings and human rights conditions?
Well, let me give you an example of a decision I took when I was at DFID. We were giving budget support to the government of Ethiopia. Now, budget support, you're basically saying to the government, you've got a plan to get kids into school, to improve your health service, you could do with more money to make it happen, we'll give you the money, you get on and make it happen. That's the one end of the spectrum. At the other end of the spectrum, in the case of Zimbabwe, we were helping to feed the population, but we didn't give money to President Mugabe's regime. So you have a different ways of delivering aid. There was the election, which was actually extraordinarily free in Ethiopia, which led to a lot of opposition MPs being elected. They were promptly arrested and charged with various offences. And I took the view that that breached, if you like, the relationship that we had on the basis of which we had agreed to give budget support. Now, the dilemma you face, Bronwyn, in those circumstances, do you punish the people of Ethiopia for the decision that their government have taken. And I took the view it wasn't right to punish them, and therefore we said we will give our aid but in a different form, so we stopped the budget support and found a different mechanism. Now, that was not popular in all quarters. It certainly wasn't popular with Mr. Meles, with whom I had a discussion about this. But I thought it was important to do it because if, I suppose the question someone would ask is, if a government doing this, this, this and this is not enough for you to decide as a nation you're not going to give budget support anymore, then what actually would it take? And so that was how I wrestled with what Stephen has just described, you know, the complexities and the difficulties, and that was the decision I took in that particular case.
Great. Let's take a few more. There was the one here. Please.
I could take one more and then I have to shoot off, unfortunately. I've got a Welsh thing.
A Welsh thing. I'm
okay.
My grandfather was a furnaceman from down the road in Port Albert. I'm going to release
you. I
feel strongly about the Port Albert thing.
A critical question, as you both talked about Europe, and my question is that if Britain decides to leave the European Union, in that scenario, what should be our relationship with the rest of the world?
Excellent. Can we squeeze in any more on Europe? Any more? All right, one in the corner. You've been very patient.
I just wanted to ask a question, very close to home for me, about the recent developments in Poland and what the government's reaction to the developments in Poland and the new nationalistic government should be.
Great. Stephen.
Well, I think if we were to leave the European Union, our role in the world would be vastly diminished. Our membership of the European Union ensures that we are part of a bloc, a population of 500 million people. It gives us influence both in Brussels, but also via Brussels to the other capital cities of the EU, and of course to the rest of the world, Washington, Beijing, etc. So I think we would quite rapidly become an irrelevant nation in many, many ways if we were to leave the EU. What we need to do within the EU is work far more constructively on an EU foreign relations strategy. Let's call it a foreign policy. It's probably taking a little bit too far for the time being. But if you look, for example, at the relationship with Russia, the lifeblood of the Russian economy is its oil and gas. One of the reasons it has so much leverage over the European Union is because it plays one member state off against the other in terms of gas imports and exports. Now, if we were able to create an energy union across the EU with proper investment in interconnectors, proper investment in a single market for energy, the relationship with Russia would shift immediately. The seesaw would tip. So that's just one example of where greater cooperation at the EU level can have a direct impact in terms of Britain's own national interest in the way that it deals with a major player like
feasible?
Russia.
Is that feasible?
The energy union. Well, it's there. I mean, the plan is there. It, of course, requires investment. Member states have signed up to a whole range of projects which would drive energy union forward, but very little of the funding has actually followed from that. But there's a very clear strategic rationale for a more integrated energy policy, particularly in terms of the relationship with Russia. So I think, you know, the referendum, which I think will come in June, has to be about Britain's role in the world, actually. If it's just about, you know, how much money should a Latvian taxi driver get, that clearly is just not going to be a winning track for us. We've got to make this a much bigger picture, and we've got to make a progressive and patriotic case for our membership of the European Union. We've got to make it clear that the psychology of leaving is the psychology of defeat. And actually, Britain is a proud nation with a strong history of international engagement. And the idea that we are not able to fight our own corner in Brussels, therefore we better get out, is, in my opinion, a deeply unpatriotic argument. So I think we've got to turn that we've got to make it clear that nationalism is the antithesis of patriotism. And the rhetoric that you hear from UKIP and the UKIP-light wing of the Tory party is a nationalistic rhetoric. That's not what our patriotism is about. We've got to redefine that. And I'm actually very excited about this EU referendum, because I think it gives the Labour Party the chance to redefine what it means to be patriotic.
And that's what you'd say to the Polish government?
Oh, Polish government. Worrying developments there. I think it reflects a broader trend of a slip towards populism. It seems to be, looking at history, the automatic reaction from a big economic crisis is that kind of idea that people pull up the drawbridge and become isolationist and become, you know, the kind of populist answers are the ones that people start looking for. And I think it's regrettable if that is indeed what's happening in Poland. But I'm an optimist on these things. I think that the story of the transition in Central and Eastern Europe is an inspiring story, and I think one that, in the end, I think will, I hope, anchor Poland back in a more progressive politics. And of course, the symbiotic relationship they have with Germany is critical here. If there's a sense, you know, that relationship with Berlin is starting to be quite seriously jeopardised, that will, I think, also see a change of minds and hearts in Warsaw.
No, I agree, it's one of the inspiring movements of our time. I think we've rather taken it for granted, taken its success for granted.
Absolutely.
Stephen, I'm going to release you before challenging you on the extraordinary claim that China is the Germany of Asia. In an odd way, neither China nor Germany will give you any thanks for, but you're released. Many thanks indeed for joining us.
Yeah, I do have a little bit more time. I mean, I would. Then there was one. I mean, I agree with what Stephen said about Poland. To come to your question, to be honest, we are potentially 5 months away. You know, we're getting on to the end of January. If the referendum is at the end of June, this is very, very little time. And this is the biggest decision, as I said at the beginning, we're going to face for 40 years. And I hope you'll forgive me if, rather than speculating on what we might do if we lose, I intend to put all of my energy in those 5 months into making sure that we stay in. But I thought Stephen made a really, really important point about the way in which this debate and this decision is seen. Because there is a view which presents the United Kingdom as poor, put upon, undermined, sovereignty disappeared, being battered around by our European neighbours, which is, one, profoundly mistaken, and two, you know, undersells the country and who we are, the influence that we have in the world, what we have to offer. And I think Stephen was absolutely right that this is an important part of winning that argument in the referendum. It's that argument that we should leave that he put it. Unpatriotic, and that actually Britain benefits. We amplify our voice, we bring our experience, we have links around the world in Europe through the Commonwealth and other historic relationships, and it is a strength that we're part of this union. And if you're going to deal with the problems of the world, and this is my other argument, is you're not going to do that by turning your face away from your immediate neighbours. You're going to do it by working even harder with them to confront the problems of the world and take advantage of the opportunities that it presents. And we've got to be resolute about that in arguing the case. And I think we're going to win, because I think that case is going to win out over the contrary argument that says we should be fearful about Europe and our part in it and try and step off into the unknown, which the outers can't describe. They can't.
What about our sovereignty? Does it mean that our membership within the European Union, it's much more important than giving up our sovereignty?
Well, someone was saying to me the other day, if you go back and read the booklets from the 1975 referendum, and look, I've changed my mind since 1975 on Europe, so, you know, hands up, because the Labour Party, as many people in the room, but not everyone will know at the time, the Labour Party, majority of the Labour Party and the trade union movement were opposed to our remaining members of the common market as it then was. And what's happened over 40 years is we have the same situation, a divided party, a renegotiation and a referendum. The only thing that's changed is the roles of the two parties have been reversed. Labour Party, the Labour movement, is now united in its support for our membership of the European Union, and it's the Tories who are divided. And David Cameron, in the end, thought, how am I going to deal with this? Let's go and see what Harold Wilson did. And it is a repeat in that sense. And the argument at the time was, we were heading for a state called Europe. Countries like Britain wouldn't exist anymore. We'd all be absorbed into this amorphous mass. Now, no one could look at the country we are today, the decisions we've taken about the kind of society we are, the legislation we have, and say that the United Kingdom has been weakened. Yes, we have pooled our sovereignty. Why? In the interests of dealing with the problems of the world and taking advantage of its opportunities. We pool our sovereignty when we say, the European Union nations, here's our offer on climate change. Now, I regard that as a strength and not a disadvantage. Yes, I would like the Commission to get the message, I think it's beginning to, about the pace and scale of legislation. I support the red card initiative, where if sufficient parliaments wave the red card at a proposal, then it doesn't go ahead. So I want to see change in Europe, but you get change in Europe by being part of Europe and not by walking away from Europe.
Let's take a few more. Woman here.
Good question.
I just wanted to ask a question about when we decide what we can do and to whom. Just on the example of Syria, you said, Hillary, that Daesh is something that needs to be removed. But if the Syrian people voted to keep Assad, that's something we wouldn't intervene with. How does that square up to your earlier analogy of we don't accept domestic violence going on at home because it's domestic? Surely the beaten woman's decision to stay doesn't affect the police's powers and responsibilities to protect. So when can we decide when something needs to be removed or when we need to accept?
Yeah.
Fantastic. Thank you. Let's take a couple
What's
more people
name?
Being
Charlotte.
Thanks. And so the song being great. Sorry, right in the middle here. Yep. In fact, there's two of you. Let's take you two. I'm going to come to you in the corner and over there as well. So you two.
I was wondering what opportunities and challenges you see coming from Africa, given that most of the population growth in the next few decades is probably going to come from Africa.
Yep.
I was interested in the point that Stephen made about the European Union being ahead of its time. And I thought, is that actually a good thing? Because obviously we've seen the Schengen system having to be suspended and the migrant crisis and freedom of movement in general being quite strict. So whether that is a good thing.
Yeah. Excellent.
Okay. Well, Charlotte, you asked the most difficult question of all, which is what the world is wrestling with. What is the right thing to do in the circumstances? Now, if you take the case of Syria, the civil war began and it unfolded. Then there were the chemical weapons attacks. There was a debate here in Parliament in 2013 about what we should do. The Prime Minister originally said, I'm going to turn up, ask for agreement to start bombing Syria pretty quickly. Is that okay with you? We as the Labour opposition said, I'm afraid that really isn't going to do. And it is worth it for those who want to understand exactly what happened in the House of Commons that day to go back and look at the two motions there were, the government motion in the end and our motion. And what our motion said was we would be prepared to consider, but it would be subject to a whole load of things, like proving that President Assad had done it, it going to the UN considering it. Because I believe very strongly that we should make the UN work to take those decisions. But having said that, there are occasions where the UN cannot act or will not act, or where the veto is used to prevent the UN from acting. And then you get to the really tricky bit. Do you say, well, I'm sorry, because the UN won't do it, then we're not going to do anything. Now, Kosovo is an example of that. I supported what we did in Kosovo, but it was not with the UN's authorization. And what happened in 2013 is that both the motions went down. So we were left with nothing, and that is what happened. Look, the people who live under Daesh's yoke have absolutely no say about their existence and what they do to them. What we should be trying to achieve through these negotiations for the people of Syria is to give them the chance to decide in future how and by whom they are governed. And that, so that is a fundamental difference between the two. And there is a very, very broad measure of agreement amongst a very large number of countries about the threat that Daesh represent, which is why there is a very big coalition that is taking action in a variety of forms, and a smaller number who are taking action in militarily. And we have seen, since the debate in Parliament on the 2nd of December, the retaking of Ramadi. Now, that has been Iraqi effort, but support from the air has made an important contribution. And I was heartened by the report that I read in the paper this morning that it is said that Daesh have had to cut the pay that they're offering to their fighters because the efforts are being made to get at their finances. And they finance their operations by the oil production and smuggling, which is why the first target for the RAF was those facilities, by their kidnapping and ransom operation, and the money that they've nicked from the places that they have taken over and invaded. So putting pressure on them in a variety of ways is, I think, the right thing to do if you accept the basic argument that Daesh are a threat to everyone and they need to be dealt with. On your question...
Yeah, I just want to press you on this a bit. We will come to these other two about Africa and about the EU being ahead of its time. But Charlotte's point is about the moral choice there, not as much about process. She's saying,
but
you know, have some
choice.
People... Yeah, but she's saying, have some groups like Daesh, they seem to be saying... done things that are so bad that you say, look, we are not going to deal with them. But then how do you differentiate between that and President Assad, who, whatever we thought several years ago at that point of choice, now appears to have bombed, we're really pretty sure he's bombed his people several, many times over. And it seems to be an answer about process and let them choose isn't quite satisfactory, even if that process were possible, and you're talking about a country where half the people have been displaced and a quarter of them are outside the country.
Yeah.
But even if you do that, she seems to be just speaking for quite a few people and saying, have some groups really put themselves beyond the pale of negotiation, or is there a sense in which you really want to allow for any of these groups to be negotiated with if that's part of a settlement of the country?
Well, I, in relation to Syria, as I tried to set out earlier, I think they are two connected problems, but they are separate in the sense that the civil war, and we want it brought to an end, there is no, I think, military solution to the civil war. Now, the Russians chose to come in to support President Assad because he was suffering reverses on the battlefield. They wanted to support their ally. They want to protect their strategic interest. But everybody, I think, recognises that the only way out is by negotiation. That's why the Vienna peace talks have been so important. I don't see anyone arguing, well, no, there's a different way of dealing with this. And one has to recognise that President Assad... For the Alawite community and the other minorities in Syria, they look to him and say, well, at least he stands between us and these other people over there who would like to do some pretty awful things to us. So we have to acknowledge that. Daesh exists there because of the chaos and the vacuum created by the civil war, and they set up shop, and then they went woomph into Iraq. They were not far from Baghdad. And then Iraq came to us and other nations and said, can you give us a hand to try and resist this invasion? So the broader point I would make is simply this, and it's not meant to be a simple answer, but just because you can't do the right thing everywhere has never struck me as a really good argument for not trying to do the right thing somewhere.
Great, thanks. And then we had Africa.
Right.
And... Well, Europe ahead of its time. Well,
we could spend all the rest of the evening and on into tomorrow talking about Africa. Look, I think this is a continent of extraordinary strength, vitality and opportunity. When we were doing the commission on Africa in the run-up to the Glen Eagles summit, and I was vice chair of that, if you've never read it, it's worth going back and reading the introduction, which I had nothing to do with the writing of, but it paints a picture for many people who, if you ask them, you know, describe Africa, they would say disease, disaster, devastation, and not actually see economic opportunity, enterprise, innovation, material wealth, great potential. And if you look at the continent, there's less conflict than there was, and that is a good thing. There have been more democratic transitions than there were before, and that is a good thing. Now, it's got huge challenges. You mentioned Nigeria and South Africa. Nigeria, this enormous country. The question for Africa is how are we going to provide, how are the nations going to provide economic opportunity for a growing younger population? Because as we have seen, what is driving some of the migration northwards is both conflict. Lots of people want to leave Eritrea. I know, because every time I do my constituency surgery, people arrived in this country from Eritrea. They've come from Zimbabwe, they've come from the Congo, they've come from other countries, Somalia, because they couldn't live a life where they were born and brought up. So there's a lot still to be done, and I think the African Union is providing really good leadership, but it's still in its early days. It needs greater support to make that happen. And the second thing I would say is that there's still a lot to be done to develop economic opportunity, to build customs unions. I mean, it used to be said a decade ago, I don't know whether it's changed, that if you wanted to travel east-west in West Africa, because the transport connections weren't terribly good, it was sometimes quicker to get on a plane, fly to Europe, get on another plane, and fly back. So, sort that out so that you can encourage economic opportunity. And the last point I'd make is the impact of this. When I last looked at the figures, which was some time ago, there were three times as many mobile phones as fixed landlines in sub-Saharan Africa. And this becomes a means of transferring money. And the farmers I remember meeting when I went to a village called Makani Salam in Ethiopia, who were traipsing downhill to go to the market. It was going to take them 2 hours to get there and 4 hours against gravity go back up the hill home, only to get to the market to discover no one's buying what they're selling today, or the price is too low for them to make anything. Pick this up, ring. And that's why those who are fishing off the coast of East Africa will say, OK, so what are the prices in Dar es Salaam? Not so good, let's try Zanzibar. So the impact that technology has on economic opportunity, it's our story, and it's taking place in Africa. So I think there is a real opportunity, but in the end, good governance everywhere will be fundamental to whether those opportunities can be seized and the problems dealt with. And that's down to the people of those countries and the people they choose to elect. Now, ahead of its time,
Europe ahead of
time. We're not part of Schengen. I suppose that's another argument going back to your question, which is, although we are part of the European Union, different member states choose to participate in certain bits of it. We didn't join the euro. We were absolutely right not to join the euro. That was one of the many achievements of the last Labour government. We didn't. And yes, in this renegotiation, making sure that there is parity and equal treatment for the euro countries, but also the non-euro countries, is really important. So it shows that you can have within the union people opting in or not opting in to different arrangements. And of course, Schengen has been put under great pressure by the flow of refugees that we have seen. Now, you need to try and work out a way of dealing with that as European countries together. But the other lesson is the one I referred to right at the beginning. Don't we have an interest in playing our part in trying to prevent people from having to flee in the first place? Which goes back to your... It was Rachel's earlier question.
It was. Let's try and squeeze in just a few more, if that's all
right.
Fine.
We'll take a minute. Last round, I think.
Woman, on the...
I just wanted to ask a question which pertains to what Charlotte was saying.
What's your name?
Oh, Lucy Green.
Hi.
Which is that it seems to me that we as a country and in general still conceive of our foreign policy in quite a traditional way in terms of the state system, and that one of the big challenges that we face is maybe conceiving of non-state actors and how we deal with those, and ISIS would be an example of that. And I don't know whether the answer lies within multilateral organisations, but it is a well-known fact now that most of the conflict that happens in the world is not interstate, it's intrastate. So I wonder whether you might want to make a comment about how we actually perhaps change our manner of thinking to address those particular realities, and whether we need a rethink, a reboot of the way that we approach our policy.
Lucy, thank you. There's a very, very patient people right at the back here. Go on.
Could I ask a question? It's more almost like a follow-up question to your Syria answer. I think the idea that if if you're intervening one human rights violation amongst others, and I'm not sure that argument really adds up. I think in the Syrian conflict, President Assad, it's really been shown that he is violating more human rights than ISIS are, and he is causing genocide against the Sunni populations, and that's been very much documented. So I feel that the bombing against ISIS, the logic behind it, it is a bit flawed. And I think if you were to bomb ISIS and military deal with Assad, I think that would make a lot more sense. So I think you either kind of have to go with both of them or neither of them. So I think if you just choose ISIS over Assad, I mean, there's no real moral reason why he was, as Assad is committing making more crimes.
Thank you for your point. And your name?
Frank.
Frank. And there were two others. Sorry, I beg your pardon. Yes.
I wanted to ask a question earlier in relation to the impact of the draft investigatory powers bill on our international relations. Obviously, given that the bill has extraterritoriality clauses in it, and obviously then.
Sorry, say that again. I got the investigatory powers bill, but it was the last bit I didn't quite catch.
There are clauses in it that pertain to extraterritoriality, so we'll have impact on international companies, and obviously we'll have impact on. Yeah. Britain's relations with other companies those companies may be based in. So obviously with the potential that we might be spying on citizens of obviously other countries, or do you thought that might put a strain on any sort of relations that we might have, particularly the EU and with the United States?
Thank you. And I'm just going to squeeze in one. There was someone, a very patient hand over here. Yes, you.
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah, there's a question, I guess, following up potentially from the first one. So. Whether or not, Joe had mentioned the point earlier that active UK foreign policy isn't necessarily a given, and I wanted to ask Hilary whether or not where you saw Britain's position in the world and where our focus is specifically on hard and soft power. You talked beforehand about the power of technology, and Britain obviously has a long history in the world with regards to diplomacy, but equally the debate is increasing around Trident, and we obviously had the debate on Syria, and to see whether or not you thought that the focus for Britain should be on, or whether or not it always will be on hard power, or whether or not we should take more of a position on soft power.
Right. Perhaps I'll come back to those two questions. Lucy, and sorry, what was your?
Ben.
Ben. Okay. I'll come back to you at the end. Now, Frank, so can I ask you a question? So are you advocating that the UK and other nations should intervene militarily in the Syrian civil war?
Well, I think that there should be a whole response. It shouldn't just be it shouldn't just be for ISIS. I think it should be like an intelligent response which looks at the whole country, and not just painting ISIS as this evil, which compared to Assad isn't that much more evil, I guess.
Well, I would say in response that I think that's what the world community is trying to do. Now, the prior question is, if you look back over the last 4 years, what might have been done differently at what stage to prevent us ending up where we are? And that is clearly work in progress, given responsibility to protect as a concept. But I think what the international community is trying to do at the moment is precisely to have an intelligent response. Question. What, given where we are currently in Syria and the civil war, what is the quickest potential means to bring the barrel bombing to an end? Now, I would say to you, the quickest means of doing that is to get the negotiations going and to have a ceasefire. Now, that requires political will on the part of Assad, but also all of the countries that are supporting the different sides in this 6-7-8-sided civil war, however you want to count the combatants. Now, I think that is where rightly we are focusing our effort at the moment, because I would say to you that is the quickest way of getting the outcome that we want. The alternative is to intervene militarily in the civil war, which I do not support. Yes, of course.
Why does it make sense to bomb ISIS then? and not kind of like have the same process on the side, but vice versa? Like?
Because there will have to be a negotiation about the future of Syria, and that's what the Vienna process is all about. And the UN is playing a leading role in helping to make that happen. I don't see, lots of countries don't see what there is to negotiate with about when it comes to Daesh. There isn't. Because, well, I mean, you may have heard what I said.
I mean, the retort might be that if they were bigger and more powerful, then there would be.
Well, one of the objectives of our policy is to make sure they're not bigger and more powerful because of who they are, what they're doing, what they believe. Because they believe that they have not just a right to kill other people with whom they disagree, other Muslims, Christians, the Yazidis, they think they have a duty to do it. And if you're faced with that, it's a choice, and you make the choice, as I did and others. Either I think they need to be, we need to stand up against them. That's my view, and that's the argument that I made in the House of Commons. So they are, of course, connected in the conflict, but negotiation is the quickest way to bring that to an end. That's my assessment. You may take a different view. I'm not in favour of us, the West, intervening militarily in the Syrian civil war. That would be the wrong thing to do. The negotiations are the right thing to do. That's why we support it. And Daesh, I think we are doing the right thing as well. Now, on the investigatory powers bill, look, this is a challenge for all countries. At its heart, how do we balance security and liberty? That is what the debate in Parliament is going to be about. When do we think it is legitimate for the state to acquire information about those who would do us harm? And I certainly accept that the state needs to have the ability to do that. And the technology is changing in an extraordinary way, and our legislation has not caught up with it. So if two people who are trying to plan a bomb attack are communicating using WhatsApp as opposed to a telephone, well, then I think it's our security services who work really, really hard to keep us safe. You know, 7/7, the failed plot a couple of weeks later. You've seen the court cases, you've seen the convictions, you've seen the plots that have been disrupted. There's still a serious risk, but that we need to give them the tools to do the job. Now, the balance in that is we have to trust the security services and the police that they will use it for the purpose for which it's intended and not for purposes for which it isn't intended. And therefore, at the heart of the debate in Parliament about the Investigatory Powers Bill will be what is the scrutiny and what is the oversight, what is the role of judicial oversight in this. And Andy Burnham has said when it was first announced that there would be judicial oversight of the issuing of intercept warrants, which is basically permission to bug someone, bug their telephone, bug their flat, bug their car, through which information is gathered, the impression was that the judge would look at the evidence, but it now seems to be the case that the judge would just look at the process. And Andy Burnham has said, well, that isn't really good enough. And so we will return to this when the current consultation is over and decide. And on the international aspects of it, if communicating, bless you, Bronwyn, if people are communicating with others in other countries to plot attacks that might kill you or I or my children in this country, well, then we have an interest in sharing information with others. And we need to be able to find out who's plotting where in order to protect our own security. And these are really, really difficult questions. And ultimately, society has to decide, where do you strike that balance? You get it wrong, and people die, and then their parents say, what did you know? What could you have done? Oh, well, we didn't do that because. And they say, so you weren't prepared to do that, and as a result, my child died. And politicians, elected representatives, feel this responsibility particularly, because we're the ones who have to make the choice, and we're the ones who then get held to account if we don't get it right. On the final, well, the first and the final question, Lucy, you're right. An Islamic state, as they try to call themselves, and Daesh, as we call them, because they're not a state, but if they were a state, then, well, certainly Iraq as a nation would be at war with them, because they've invaded Iraq. But they're not. And so there is a question about the international legal framework. How do you deal with that? And I don't know what the answer is, but I think it's clear that the question itself has been raised. Were you just talking about the non-state actors who are involved in conflict, or were you also alluding to the role of non-state actors in our diplomatic policy? Because I wasn't quite sure.
I was mainly talking about conflict.
You were.
The other one is a much larger question.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, fine.
Mainly that if, you know, if we do have a kind of responsibility to protect and we, you know, kind of take conflict overseas very seriously and performing, you know, in accordance with people's human rights and things like that, you know, it strikes me that the system within which we kind of operate is very much state-based. So even with dealing with something like Daesh, it goes up to a state-based decision-making system within the UN. And I don't know whether the answer is perhaps, as you suggested earlier, a more regional-based system where there's kind of shared consensual responsibility about security. But most people who, you know, whose lives are in danger are kind of endangered by people who live within their own borders, whether that is from their own state or from the people in their state.
Yeah.
We no longer operate where it's a kind of one country versus another, state-by-state conflict basis. And I wonder whether the fact that the UN was set up to deal with precisely that, a state-by-state kind of conflict, it's perhaps kind of past a certain sell-by date by which we need to rethink some of the ways with which we kind of both deal with kind of sovereignty, but also with protecting people.
I don't think it's past its sell-by date, but we need it to be more effective.
Yeah.
And that is certainly the case. And if you take the example of Sudan and Darfur, well, now there was a classic example. Interestingly, what was going on in Darfur didn't. There was some interest in the UK. There weren't a lot of demonstrations about what was going on in Darfur, in Britain. It'd be interesting to reflect on why that might be the case. Probably because the United States of America and Britain were the two largest donors to the humanitarian effort. In that circumstance. Now, what we were able to achieve, well, under the auspices of the UN, but with British, American and other aid, we helped to keep people alive in the camps. As I said earlier, we supported the African Union. It was difficult dealing with the state of Sudan, getting in humanitarian supplies, making it difficult for NGOs, permits, all those kind of things that I found myself arguing about with the government at the time in the interest of making sure that people could be effectively protected. But there were also peace negotiations in Abuja in 2006 in an attempt to bring the conflict to an end. One of the rebels signed up, the other two refused. I represented the UK at those negotiations. So I think we have in some places shown the capacity to make it work. But you've raised a very important question about the nature of conflict going forward. And the international order, I would say, has got to adapt to reflect that. And finally, the answer to your question, Ben, was I don't think it's a competition between the two. I think it needs to be both. When it comes to defence policy, the fundamental responsibility of government and oppositions that aspire to be in government is to defend the nation. That is the most important responsibility that we've got. And we will see that played out during the course of the defence review that has just been launched. But we should not underestimate, although we are not an imperial power anymore, the influence that Britain has, because we have, in my experience, a first-class diplomatic service. And I say that from a lot of experience meeting our diplomats around the world. We have our cultural influence. We have our language. Now, we're notoriously bad at learning other people's languages, but this... This is a very, very powerful influence in the world, English. And I think we need to make use of all of those means to express our views, to work with others, to make the international order work, to build and strengthen the United Nations, to deal with conflict, and to be proud about doing so, because as a nation, I think we have a lot to offer. We've got a lot to learn. But I see a future in which we cooperate with others in trying to deal with these problems. And that's why the end of June, really, really, really important, because the way the world sees us will be shaped by the decision that we make in that referendum. So that's why we have to win. And thanks all for coming tonight.
Thank you all very, very much. Apologies to those of you who couldn't get questions in. Thanks. We wanted to dwell on some of them. But thank you to the Fabian Society, to the Frederick Ebert Stiftung, to the panelists here and departed.
To the fans. Absolutely.
And thank you all for terrific questions. We're delighted to have you here. Commend to you tomorrow. Tomorrow's issue of Prospect magazine asking the question, the end of growth, by Robert Gordon, answered by Larry Summers, no. They'll be cheerful. Thanks very much. Have a good trip home.
I look forward to meeting you.
That was terrific. Man. Thank you very much. It was very good.
I really enjoyed it. It was excellent. It was, do you know, the first time I ever addressed the Fabians, I went to the Chiswick Fabian Society and I spoke on Europe.
Yeah.
And I thought I'd done pretty well. And the first man from the panel, he said, that was a very interesting talk, Mr. Ben. I was about 27. He said, and I told you this story. Do you know what? I felt about this small. And I realised when you go to a Fabian event, you're going to be subjected to a cross-examination.
And it didn't disappoint.
No, absolutely, it still exists.
Grilling.
It does.
So that's not a
tool. Yeah, we do need to do that. And we should go back to
Excuse me, you mentioned the investigatory rights bill.
Yeah, powers bill, yeah.
You know, referring back to the Patriot Act in 2001 in the US, like initially after 9/11, that was deemed, you know, great because, you know, people, terrorism was minimalised. But afterwards, it was deemed a bit totalitarian. I mean, obviously, our security services aren't as, you know, infamous as America's with Watergate and stuff like that. But
hang on, Watergate was. Yeah, it was a criminal enterprise, not actually to do with the security services, but to do with the Republican Party. Anyway, leave that on one side.
But I was wondering, you know, how are we going to do it differently? I mean, I know that the Patriot Act has minimalised, you know, last year was, the powers of the National Security Service and stuff like that.
Well, how are we going to deal with it? We're going to deal with it in here as we debate the bill line by line and decide where you strike the balance.
Yeah.
And I said what I said in answer to the question of the gentleman at the back, because we do need to make sure that we have the ability to see what we need to see to protect ourselves, but you also have to give people reassurance that you're not going to be poking into...
Yeah, because there's a massive, you know,
part surfing of, activities.
You know, freedom, you know, like...
No,
know.
Which is true. The difficult bit is, heaven forbid, but supposing, you know, tomorrow I committed a terrorist act and no one had ever, the security service had never known about me beforehand, so we were completely new, what's the first thing they'd want to do? The first thing they'd want to do is to find out with whom have I been associated. And therefore, if they haven't got my records as someone they weren't interested in, they can't do that. So that is the argument for a period, you collect everybody's, because you don't know which of the records you need to look at in order to protect yourself. Now, that's one of the things that we're going to have to wrestle with when we deal with the legislation. And it is all about balance in the end. It's what are you prepared to consent to in order to protect yourself and those you love? That's the question.
Yeah.
And how can you be sure the powers are properly used?
So you're going to vote for it?
So there are going to be particular bits of it.
Yeah.
So what I've said and what Andy said is we accept that the legislation needs to be updated, but how it's done and what safeguards are put in is what's being consulted on now, and we will debate in Parliament. And it depends how the government responds to the consultation. All right? Good. Hi, nice to see you.
You're a tall ex-Foreign Office, probably the only one in the room.
Well, I know, and I hope you liked what I said about you and your colleagues.
Absolutely. And if I can help any time,
if you are living... Oh, yes, you are very close indeed. It's nice. Thank you very much for coming. You should have chipped in, given all your experience. Oh, did you? I'm sorry.
No, I think my question's too long for this. Let's see, do you have it?
Yes.
Thanks a lot. Hi, Andy.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Same journey.